thank you for everyone for coming. I see some familiar faces and some new faces, so perhaps some of you have heard us talk a little bit about this already. I'm going to assume that probably most of you have seen the exhibition already, maybe in various states of illumination, depending on whether you've come when the morning sun is streaming through these colored windows, red, blue, and green, kind of rectangular forms, creating a kind of rigid grid within the exhibition space, or perhaps more recently in the afternoon when there's a kind of diffuse lighting that illuminates the space and creates a kind of disorienting hue that's somehow something between a human and a kind of digital or artificial way of seeing the world. But I have, of course, what I hope is that you've seen the exhibition and started to draw your own interpretations, your own impressions, perhaps your own questions and confusions, especially about some of the strange and uncanny ways of moving and kind of putting images together that are very, you know, striking in this exhibition and typical of Troika's practice. I have said quite a bit about my own interpretation of the show, which some of you heard, I think, last night, and I've also written it down. For the, of course, we can come back to that. But so this, for this reason, it's a pleasure actually then to turn over the conversation to the artists to approach this exhibition in a different way, rather than taking a kind of summary approach to the broad topics, which I think is bears, but. Since we have the artists present, it becomes possible to ask how you do this and how different sorts of what I'm so struck by in your work is how kind of small technological features that we might not realize are options, like ways of using devices differently or using technologies differently, suddenly become in your work whole windows into a whole way of perhaps seeing the world differently or producing different kinds of light, different kinds of sound. There's something intensely technical about the work, and then it opens into a world. And one example, so I'd like to ask you two questions. One is a kind of how did you do it question. We all want to know how the plants seem to dance and writhe and wiggle, and you know, what are they? Are they electronic devices that do a little dance, or are they some sort of a weird plant? So what is going on there? And so maybe I'll pose that to one of you, but what I'm also driving at is I want to know about the chicken and the egg, you know? Do you notice these strange kind of affordances, possibilities, ways of using light or using sound or using an old toaster oven in a different way from, and does this drive the work, or is it, you know, what is this relationship between an idea and its technological manifestation? You know, how does that work in your practice?
I guess you can't really separate either or. It's like when we work, we very often, you know, you've been to the studio. The studio has like a big workshop downstairs. It's a weird and wonderful world that mixes like traditional medium, like, you know, we have a painting room, but we also have like a storage room that often impresses people because it's all stored in gray boxes, and you would go through the gray boxes and you would see motors for electronics, a power supply, a chemical for explosives, and you have a wide variety. We engage in a wide variety of technique, and this question of the chicken and the egg, I think, is relevant to like contemporary artistic practice. We engage systematically and to very great depths with the medium we are using, and it becomes really a situation where you don't know which one is first. But I guess since the whole enterprise of our work is to reveal different way of looking at the world, because I think that's the most fundamental thing you can do as an artist. This is my opinion. There's many ways of approaching that, but the most fundamental thing we can do is like trying to disentangle what the Western culture has created, you know, in terms of a very advanced capitalistic system, technocratic understanding of the world, but you know, like, and the crisis that goes with it. If you start to discover a different way of seeing the world, you may be able to suggest different way to behave in it. And that's the same with the technology. So the installation we have in Langen with the water coming up, you know, like we have a similar kind of installation that was the precursor to the Animatma with the plant moving, in which you see literally rain going upwards. And that all things started by making a coffee. So I made a coffee at one point, and then you hear, oh my God, this pump is very weird because it goes tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk. So he has a frequency. Oh wow, he has a frequency. So what happens if you start to sample that? And so which one is first? It's kind of a synergetic relationship between thinking and doing, I guess.
I definitely want that coffee. Especially today. But okay, so you didn't answer the first question, which is how does this one work? And then
how do you do it?
This is, but no, thank you. It's really interesting. I want to come back to the broader question, but let's not skip over this very interesting detail.
So you probably have noticed the silicon field. Some people have actually asked what those silvery, shiny rocks are, and it's silicon, which is a man-made material and the basic building block of all computer chips, everything that we carry on us. And underneath this mountain of silicon, there's an apparatus, which for us is as important to the work, when even though there we're covering it in these shiny rocks, it is part of the artwork, as important to the artwork as everything that you see. And under this mountain you have a mechanism that vibrates the thistles ever so slightly. So if you were to see it under normal light conditions, you would see a vibrating plant. The light, however, that is shining on the plants, so you will have seen two suspended light fixtures. They are fitted with, I don't know, that's probably also LEDs, with light-emitting diodes, a specific lighting technique that you'll find anywhere and everywhere nowadays. And what typically seems to us as a continuous light is actually a pulsating light. So everything is pulsating around us. And so are these two lights in the saal as well. So we set the frequency of the pulse, the speed at which they pulse, and the frequency at which they pulse to a specific setting that allows us to tune the vibration and the frequency of the light. And by that mechanism, you have the impression of the thistles moving. And what happens there is that the light only allows you to see every other frame or every other image. Their image is cut out, which for us is very representative of a digital method, which is all about segmentation. And as these frames or these segmented images are lined up, you could imagine a movie projector, because a movie projector lines up these images as well. And if they're played to us in a continuum, you perceive the motion. And there we perceive the motion of a slow motion of these thistles dancing. And so the method by which we create this, we could call it illusion, but we shy away from calling it like that because it's a certain reality we're looking at. So one is not more real than the other. And the devices, these lighting devices, aid to shine a different light on these plants.
Yeah, I think the sort of technological bit, no, that's a starting point. But from there onwards, there is whole research that starts into like which plant species are actually of interest to us. So if you looked at anemone, like dahlias, roses that just didn't quite work, and that the fact that they are thistles, it's really important to us. It's a sort of pioneer species that grows in wastelands, which links back to thematic that comes back over and over in our work, is the need for natural resources to sustain the technological apparatus. So there is a starting point, but then to us it's really important that it's not just the how, but what is it actually that you see? And to us, in effect, what for us this installation really just creates a gateway to enable us to see something that happens, but that normally lies outside of our sensorial spectrum. Plants move all the time, but we just want to open up, you know, that our way of perceiving plant life, that there is an alternate intelligence, a different form of consciousness.
So let's talk a little bit about chopping things up into bits, slices, pixels, the raindrops or drops of water. This seems to be a recurrent theme. We see this also in the set of paintings, Irma Watched Over by Machines, which is literally a digital image, the machine being the digital camera, photographing scenes from Hurricane Irma. They're based on CCTV footage that are normally recording traffic patterns, you know, seeing if somebody's run a red light or something very fascinating like that, in the process of which we are producing absolutely massive quantities of photographic data, of digital photography. And this is being stored in the cloud. It's kind of out there. And if we would imagine that there might be a ghost in the machine watching these images, it would wonder what to do with all of these sort of low resolution, grainy images, which you have then blown up and magnified and kind of offered to us. And what we see is these little red squares of red, blue, and green. And once again, in another way, or less, this seems like a low tech process, right? Mm-hmm. Not so low tech, but what you're doing is you're exploiting the same cognitive process of producing a continuity. Our brains link together dots, they link together frames, they link together two different, you know, something over here with something over there. Our brains produce a curve or produce a continuity of color and allow us to see a kind of soft and gentle and naturalistic image, where what is actually shown to us are little squares. So in a way, you have the opposite image, but once again, this kind of recurrent theme in your work is the question of how things come to appear to us when they're fragmented into little bits and reassembled and fragmented and reassembled. I hardly know even where to start with this question because it recurs in so many different formats. But maybe for starters, it would be really interesting to hear you explain what might appear to us as the most low-tech element in the exhibition, namely the paintings, a very old and familiar artistic media. But how do you make them?
How do you paint them?
Good inspiration. Tell us.
You know, like okay. The interest in like in small bits is like inherently a kind of feeling or like a criticism and an exploration of reductionism, right? We have based a whole society on the assumption that you can break big problem in small ones, and if you understand the small ones, you will understand all the big problem. That doesn't work very well. We scientists know that very well now. However, all technology, and especially digital technology, is based on that. And that's, you know, Connie was mentioning the sampling just before, but it's exactly how it works. You either you record and you just take little fragment. This microphone is probably recording on a digital format. It's not recording my voice. It's taking little snippet, 44,000 times per second, or 44,000 times per second, of my voice. It's not my voice. It's just a calculation of my voice. It's the same with like images. Images are broken down, as you all know now, in pixels, and this reality is broken down. So we started to question the veracity or the validity of the digital image, which nowadays is like the prime medium to access any knowledge, and it's the prime medium by which increasingly we relate to the wilderness, the remote nature, the scenes of catastrophe, of ecological catastrophe. But it comes with its own logic. And inasmuch you could understand it on technical basis in a very short amount of time, the fact that we decided to paint one image out of a million, billion, zillion image, and we chose a particular tiny crop because there are not many pixels in there, and we start to make physically like a paint palette that has like the colors of the computer. So you can expand on that because it's a lot more complex. I don't want to monopolize the conversation. It's a way for us to do two things, essentially. A, show or reveal the limits of that digital image, and B, to empathize with another way of seeing. Because when you do that for months, you really start to see like the machine.
Yeah, so tell us what it feels like to see like the machine, to do this, to look at things. It might seem like a simplification, right? To break things into little parts, you know, understand each little bit one by one, even to use, simplified, you know, something simple technology like applying paint to canvas. That seems like familiar. But what is it like to actually do this? How long does it take? How do you do it? Who does it? And is that in any way, does it give us insight into, say, what our computers do when we save millions and billions and zillions of bytes of data, and then it has to sort through that?
Of course, extremely time intensive. So we would sit 1-2 months on one of those paintings, painting every single day, which stands in stark contrast to what Seb was saying, the millions and billions of images that are being recorded with these remote sensing cameras and CCTV cameras. Surprisingly, many of them are no longer just in urban centers. We can find them anywhere. We can find them in Antarctica. We can find them on the highest mountains, Himalaya. We can find them in our forests. We did a whole series on cameras that have been strapped to treetops. And it is a visceral sensation when we go through this footage, because we are able to actually log ourselves into these cameras and see, go back in time, choose a date, and see what these cameras will have seen at that point in time. And when one actually does that, when we do that, you realize the sheer volume of data that is being recorded. And it almost makes you sick, wondering what happens with these images. Where do they go? Which data server are they being stored at? And then we find ourselves in the studio painting one of those images, days and days and days and days. And it is maybe a personal thing, but I personally enjoy this almost meditative act very much. There's a proximity to the canvas. You're very close to it, so you don't see the image, you don't see what is emerging, but you get to know the relationship between each square and the effects of color very, very well. You become one with the something that emerges out of it. You know very well that if I start applying this pigment, then out of what is meant to be green emerges as a kind of orange. And you can see in the paintings upstairs, there are strange color fields that emerge out of something that is only painted with 16 shades of green, 16 shades of red, and 16 shades of blue. So it's, yeah, it's a state of calm and meditation, which, from a philosophical point of view, could be read as standing in a stark contrast to the technological mind, which we're mimicking there, where we're mimicking the way the machine sees. But there, they don't become mutually exclusive. So that's an interesting element for us.
Yeah, you're witnessing dissection. You don't like these dissections of like the picture plane. I mean, in a sense, it's completely ridiculous to paint like that. No, it's like no painting. Like if you ask me to paint a palm tree, I'm not gonna start by decomposing the canvas in 5 million pixels and then choose like a reduced color palette that is ultra precise and measured to the milligram of pigment, which is what we do to make the painting. You dose the shades by milligram on a micro scale, you know. Like the,
but it's also kind of really an investigation into how do machines see, no?
Yes, exactly.
To look at this bias filter, which is a filter that's part of most digital imaging devices, specifically cameras, and which is ironically based on the cones, the color cones of the human eye, which are also red, green, and blue. I mean, women tend to have a little bit more sensitivity in the orange spectrum. So if you can't see the orange in the painting, that's not our fault. But, no. But so there is no strange, there is this strange feedback loop between trying to understand machine vision that's based on the human eye. Also we are very interested, you know, in this whole apparatus and also how that technological surveillance apparatus has changed our relationship to landscape. I mean, the landscapes that are offered to us through these systems are quite often landscapes in distress, and we are really interested in using technology for things that are sort of a byproduct, something they're not intended to do. A security camera isn't intentionally put there to record a hurricane. It's a byproduct of surveillance apparatus. But again, this has changed our perception of landscape in the present times quite significantly. The fact that a lot of images we tend to see from a drone perspective now. So the horizon of how we see landscapes has completely shifted. And that then gave us impetus to look further into these camera system, because we were really fascinated by the idea that, I think, are there now 4 billion electronic eyes that
are positioned 1 billion open, yeah.
All across the globe? Well, last time we checked, might be 4 now.
Yeah, it's exponential. So when we started painting, there was 250 million, now it's 1 billion. But
And sort of, should sentience ever arise in that networked possible future being, that it would be quite ironic if the first glimpses it would have would be of natural disasters that helped exacerbate through depletion of human resources to sustain that apparatus. The other painting series, which is on view at the Langen Foundation for another week now, is based, or it was inspired by a video that we came across where a camera that was part of what is called the Internet of Tree, which is basically a network of cameras and heat sensors that's meant to prevent wildfires, recorded a wildfire coming towards it, then got engulfed in the wildfire, and the image just turned black. So there was a direct impact between the event that it was recording and the destruction of the hardware. And that we then relate in the paintings by melting the pigments in the blue channels. So it's kind of a streaky, partly broken up a fragmented image.
But I would argue that even without like the melting or like in that state, it's also eminently brutal as a method of painting. You're painting by number. It doesn't show much painterly intelligence in a way. Mm-hmm. And I love that fact that it mirrors exactly what happened with as a result to our natural environment, because it is exactly the same logic that is applied in both cases. It's the same logic that developed the camera and that destroyed the entire ecosystem.
Sorry, do you want to add something?
Sorry. Yeah, I just wanted to add, we're not talking so much about actually what it depicts, but it depicts, in this particular case, hurricanes, and what really strikes us how sort of remote sensing networks create this distance between you and the place that is recorded. As we know, we're getting more and more desensitized to what's happening at the other end of the cable or the other end of where that camera is positioned. And another aspect of these remote sensing networks is the fascinating thing of why are these cameras placed there in the first place? What data has value? What data are we actually collecting? Why are we collecting it? And why, in general, do we need to collect and measure and control everything? So we came across this paper by the University in Munich that described or attempted to do research on how to measure wilderness, which is a cultural concept rather than something that has a border, is measurable, is controllable. And yet, there is an attempt to do that. And this attempt of measuring everything is an increasing endeavor. So the question would be, where within this field of measuring everything, predicting everything, is there room for the unknown and room for things that we may never know? And yeah.
But actually, this is a nice, I've been wanting to ask you about a certain moment in the film, Buena Vista, the central new commission of this exhibition. And it's specifically this moment of being totally flooded by images, right? The film begins, and there's this sort of strange little robot, furry robot kind of creature in a landscape, and it's kind of it's hanging out there, and wonder if it might never move. I mean, this is contemporary art. That thing could have just gone on like that for 8 hours, no problem. And then all of a sudden, it's just a chaos of images, and this thing just stands there. Look a bit stunned, or maybe, you know, it's hard to say what is the chicken and the egg. You know, is the flood of images making it stand up, or is it standing up and kind of waking up maybe to memories, or what is going on there? And I want to ask about this flood of images in the video, but also what. You know, what are you thinking about this? You have actually poured through massive flood of images yourselves, looking for just the perfect frame to then spend several months painting by number in a hyperpixelated way. So this, you have engaged yourselves in this really kind of strange dialogue between being extremely close and extremely far, going through things very fast or very slow. And then this is this protagonist of the film. The robot seems, the KUKA seems to be, you know, inviting us to think about what is it like to be inundated with these images. So actually, maybe just to start by asking, you know, what are these elements in the landscape? Where do they come from? What do they mean? Like, are they paralyzing this critter with delight or with fear or with, you know, what does it tell us if it's sort of a mirror of ourselves trying to handle this massive overproduction of images of the world?
If you look at the painting, especially for Irma, watched over by machines, there's a central figure there is the palm tree. You know, and we look at like nearly all of them contain the palm tree, because the palm tree is this kind of, it's a very weirdly dystopian figure. It's the it's the older of all our hopes. If you want to see, if you want to connotate like affordance and luxury, you put palm trees. You put palm tree as a symbol of exoticism. You put palm tree as a symbol of Miami Beach. It's this kind of thing, and. So you already like have that seed, if you want, in the midst of the destruction, you still have like this figure that is standing tall. And that is a kind of misrepresentation, because if you actually do look on databases, you will find, not really with cameras, because camera records whatever they record, but if you look at Hurricane Irma on Google Images, you will see tons of palm tree. It's a central figure. The journalists love it, like a press photographer love it. And it's totally biased. And this started to make us think of how do we, because the mediation of landscape is not only through just image. It's not an image book anymore. It's a whole system, a network of database that is interlinked, and it's then fed to the AI in order to create new landscape. There was, Connie mentioned one white paper that we looked at, you know, on the topic of wilderness. But there was another one which I think is equally interesting, is that research and a data set that has been created for AI, where every image is ranked by memorability for human. Mm-hmm. So they took thousands and thousands of images and thousands of people and asked them to rate the different picture, the different landscape, according to how appealing they are, how memorable they are. And they made tons of experiments like that in order to be able to produce a weighted data set that you can then feed the AI to create more memorable landscape for, you know, for shampoo and was a product and tourism brochure, and it's a mad system. And is it a mirror? Of course it's a mirror of what we aspire to. And that thing, that's probably the most interesting thing with AI at the moment, is that AI is a neutral technology, but what do we feed it? I mean, it's not a new discourse, but we became very interested about it in relationship with the landscape. So all the element that you, to come back to your question after this long and convoluted introduction.
What was it again?
All the, well, we looked at the animation is done in a regular 3D animation environment called Cinema 4D. It's like, for those who are familiar, it's one of the software that is used to make Pixar movie, to make any kind of 3D animation movie. And you have, in as much as you have a bias about an over-representation of Arctic landscape, desert, aurora borealis, a rainbow, mountain, there are only two in the world, but there are thousands, million of those on the internet, on your desktop background, etc., etc. It's the same when you look at databases for assets to create those 3D movies. So for those who are not familiar with that, you have large databases where you can either purchase or get like some part of nature to create landscapes, artificial landscapes, like that 3D landscape. So you can get like a piece of mountain, a piece of cliff, a rock, a palm tree, another species. You can extract and pick and match whatever you want. Like the intro scene is Salar de Uyuni. You can go and buy the material for Salar de Uyuni and plug it and create that thing. And it's subject to exactly the same bias. That is, you can create thousands of Arctic landscape because you have any iceberg you want and any you know, ice cliff you want. But it's very difficult, and we tried to create like a boring landscape of Somerset even too nice.
Somerset is glad no one from Somerset is here.
No, but you know, like a regular landscape that you would not associate necessarily with exoticism, but this is your landscape of a monoculture next to your house. It's very difficult to make. So yes, the robot is both flooded by those kind of iterants of those different elements. But for us, it's nearly a MacGuffin. The landscape is nearly in equally as important and equally as a protagonist. So like, what we wanted to create is something where you don't know. your instinct, and but that's a bias as well. It's like to look at the creature that is moving, but the whole landscape is moving and moves the, you know, like the relationship is purposefully unclear. Does the robot change the landscape, or does the landscape change the robot? And there's many different ways. I've talked too long.
I wanted to actually pick up on, you know, a little bit of the process and making the animation, because ASAP makes it sounds really, really easy, plug and play, and it's quite the opposite. We actually spend probably between the three of us near to 1,000 hours on making, because all these things, they don't look like they look. They are all incredibly carefully lit and fine-tuned, and it's kind of the opposite of AI. I mean, as part of the research for the movie, we have looked at how certain AI platforms now do create landscapes according to certain prompts, but they are all incredibly either mesmerizing and beautiful, and all shot sort of in this very peaceful slow motion movie, or they are of disasters, explosions, bombs. So basically all the footage you need to make the, I don't know, some future Blade Runner, that is also very prevalent. But the way we have created it is almost more akin to a stop motion animation, where we have composed every single landscape with different sets. But what you were referring to of which elements are very prevalent is for us really interesting, because a lot of these programs are used to make renderings, of course, of visions of future environments too. So we have created, when it opened last year, an artwork for Cambridge University, where we also comment on that, and that's about the prevalence of certain tree species, for example, in these systems, where we find it really interesting how these presets are becoming part of our collective image bank, because they're simply available to developers and image creators on such an easy basis.
I wanted to ask you about the Cambridge project, because I realize again it's this practice of sampling and then showing us what kind of weird effects are caused by looking only at different kinds of frames and thinking that you can reassemble the world. This is also recurrent. So I would love to hear a little bit more about the Cambridge project, because again, you have, it's another case in which Trico's just showing us what happens when you take a tree out of software, and then take an iceberg, take a desert, take a... You know, I noticed that bamboo was missing. So I was wondering...
There was, at some point, there was bamboo in there.
There was, we took it up.
But it also seems to fuel this, I think, a very dangerous misperception in thinking about how our environment is going to survive in the future. We can reassemble and build an environment on the screen so quickly, and it can be actually quite charming, even if it looks a little weird. But we can do it so quickly and without much regard for, you know, what grows next to each other. You know, how long does it take? Do you get a cactus growing on an iceberg? Maybe not. I think it also, in a way, fuels the illusion that we can re-engineer the climate, we can re-engineer ecosystems, that bring back the woolly mammoth, let it stomp on the permafrost, and everything's going to be fine. And this is also a kind of illusion that may be misleading in conservation or environmental restoration projects. So I think that the implications of, you know, thinking through the way this imagery might mislead us in our actual actions in the world is really important. But tell us a little bit about the Cambridge project specifically.
Yeah, sure. So the Cambridge project, maybe I'll tell you what the Cambridge project is. It's called the Cambridge project. No, it's called Third Nature. And it's 15 trees that we've planted in one of the parks in front of the new Cavendish Laboratory, which is the physics laboratory. And these trees, they're mature big trees. They are the real world version, kind of the Buena Vista film, where it doesn't look like your ordinary garden or park or arboretum, for that matter, but these 15 trees are planted in a very rigid pattern, like a grid pattern, and you'll see trees that you would never see next to each other. It has an eerily artificial appearance, yet we've got real trees that rot and blow in the wind and sometimes fail, lose branches, something that never happens in the virtual world. And for me and for us, this installation is a perfect analogy of the chicken and egg analogy. There is no what was first. Was it the virtual or was it the real? There is the delineation between those two worlds increasingly blur, and we don't really know anymore what comes first. So if you go to, at least in the UK, to architectural developments, you'll find a prevalence of birch trees everywhere. Why always birch trees? And we muse that it's probably the birch tree that you can buy for the easiest the default tree in your data set that's available when you're planning your landscape in your rendering program.
Can I just back up? There was just one crucial detail that I think didn't come out totally clearly, which is that this this park that they have built looks just like the sidebar panel that you use in CAD or in architecture modeling software. So when you put your big building in the middle and then you pick some people, put them in to show, you know, scale, you know, going to work with a briefcase preferably because you'd want to get that building funded and built, and then some trees around. And you can just pick them up, but put the trees, you know, and there's a panel, and there's all the trees in a grid, and each one is on a background of green, because it also comes with special grass, right?
Yes, that's right.
And so what you have is the actual real realization of the modeling software that is used.
That's right.
It's a very direct, transplant from the virtual realm.
Now,
reality.
What's important to say then, the sidebar that Delia described, when you see the trees in there, there is no, the order of these trees and these sidebars has no order of horticultural relevance. So there is no, some trees have Latin names, others have made up names, others have common names. And it's very arbitrary, yet these are the tools that we use to build landscapes that are then built in the real world.
And so, our favorite one is the default tree.
So if you really don't know anything about
I love it.
Botany,
I would like
you take
to find
the default
one.
Tree.
Yeah. I think we all know what the default tree looks like, too.
Right?
You just picture a tree in an architectural rendering, and I think we'll know, we'll know what one it is.
But actually, in this case, the default tree is the tree that you can sort of completely model after your own liking. So you can choose the fruit, the color of its leaves, the amount of its leaves, the size of its leaf, its height, the
width of
its
growth. What's the German name?
Pflanze. And so it's like an infinitely malleable.
Yeah. It's a permanent installation?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, because we found it really, actually, it wasn't stipulated to be a park at all. Now it is, but it was meant to be what's called a common in English. But we felt that because there is a Cavendish Lab and then there's sort of a shared building with restaurants on the other side, but it's also quite a wind channel. So we actually really wanted for people to use it, and we felt that it was would become a much more inviting place for people to gather if there were actually trees, which is actually I think the greater thing for us is that it actually has worked out so that people are having picnics in there. So if you go now, you look onto this gridded landscape of this virtual tree library. In real life, you have a picnic blanket in the middle, which I absolutely love.
And yet you can read it differently. And that's what I think is very important. That makes the poetic relevance of that work is, in as much as you can see the humans looking at the trees and saying, oh, it's a gridded pattern, it's very strange, it's taken from a digital world, doesn't match together. The tree together also form a parliament. It's like a wider community of tree that have been elected that is perhaps looking at the scientist and say, what are you doing? Or questioning.
Yeah, and of course there's also a palm tree.
And there's a palm.
Actually, the palm tree in the Irma paintings, I think, is also quite relevant because it's the one tree that survives these hurricanes quite frequently because it doesn't have a rigid stem. So it bends in the flow and in the wind. So that's, yeah. I think.
But there are two things that really strike me about being represented with these images that are in a way, it strikes me as a kind of parody of my own environmental unconscious, right? Like in my dreams, do I not also dream of all the palm trees and icebergs and beautiful mountains that I've just scrolled through? I mean, this could be my imagination. And at the same time, what is even more disturbing is how are we, you know, you have introduced this question of which landscapes are memorable. There are related questions like which landscapes look natural, which landscapes look like a landscape. Katarina led me down to notice down on the river that we are invited to always look at a landscape is not just out there, right? It's framed. And if you move the frame, usually the landscape will not look quite right. And this was known by the landscape painters of the 18th and 19th century who used little devices to actually carefully frame the landscape and cut out, you know, something over there, not very picturesque, something over there, a little bit too wild. And it's something that we're very familiar with, this kind of deploying a frame that allows us to see nature, environment, landscape, whatever term is appropriate, see it in a certain way. But we're becoming very, very familiar with these kind of collage effects, both by seeing them in artistic presentations, by seeing, I think AI-generated images are actually quite different. They're very curvy, for one thing. They're not very choppy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe you have something to say about that. But are we actually... Is our standard of what is recognizable actually changing? What's memorable? Is it being driven by the technology? So when scientists investigate these questions, what makes something a recognizable image? Sometimes they're not thinking of it as a moving target that's influenced by culture. It might seem like beauty or memorability is a transcendent historical category that we would eventually all agree on it. But in the case of these landscapes, we're so saturated with these images. So are we actually starting to think of some of the scenes that we see in Buena Vista? Is that starting to look normal and natural to us?
Well, that's one of the questions we're asking. You know, it's like, of course, it's, you can see it as the robot fantasy to put iceberg in the desert, but you can also see it as an ecological result, that something that might happen, and you can see as a landscape, a memorable landscape on crack cocaine. You know, it's like this. Yes, that's how you can also create that.
I thought what you said was so beautiful. Are we out of place or are we out of time? Mm. Because Antarctica used to be a rainforest, no, millions of years ago, and when we work with Antarctic Service, British Antarctic Survey, they actually showed us these fossils of palm trees and the ginkgo leaf that was found in Antarctica where this tree species used to grow. So maybe it is also a collage in terms of time and different times and epochs coming together. Maybe one more note on the format of the movie, because and also the idea of a protagonist. And we have become so used to film and photograph everything in portrait format. And of course it is called a portrait because it has normally a protagonist in it. So that is where we have that, exactly our protagonist there. But really, there's a movement in film production which I absolutely love, and it's called Make Film Horizontal Again. And so I think we have really worked, you know, to make this extreme landscape format for the landscape of Buena Vista. It's quite, yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. It's actually formatted for a landscape to watch the film more than for a person being vertical.
Yeah. It's also to invite, you know, different point of view. Like we were talking like yesterday in terms of height. There's like if you want to see Animahatma, you have to knee down, basically. And it's the same. This all very horizontal screen that is very low invite you to crouch. You did it perfectly.
Well, this is a nice compensation from the fact that we usually don't even have to move from our shell of a chair or bed, because we just hold the phone like this or the computer on our lap like this, and you know, you don't have to climb a mountain, don't have to go out into nature with some gear and some snacks, you know, but. It can be, I mean, we've really stripped the experience down so that there's no physical comportment. We don't have to be in a place, and we don't even have to move. And you restore a little bit of that by actually transforming the exhibition space into a space that, you crouch down to see it, or you experience something different at different levels.
That was really important, actually, for us, talking about land and landscape, to put your focus is actually always downwards. Normally our attention is being sort of combated for at height, right? There are the billboards, there is Piccadilly Circus and shopping malls, everything is screaming you from top, and you're constantly walking you know, through a place like this. So for us, both in Animahatma, in the Soulscape, and also in the movie, that was a really important point, which was quite a challenge because we were lucky to get the space which we were most intrigued by here at the Schön, which has this incredible height and structure atop and this amazing window. So, yeah.
So maybe I'll just... Attention. Sorry. No, I'll just ask one last question, and then I think we've probably a good time to open it up. It's about, you know, this... One of the themes that has come up in this exhibition is about what we've been calling an AI. Everyone is talking about AI, but we've been using this term alternative intelligence, which we could kind of make peace with AI in our conversations, because it's not entirely clear what that is or could be or might be, and there's so much hope and fear attached to it. But an alternative intelligence is kind of something a bit different from what we have been developing at least in the kind of European intellectual tradition of thinking. You know, it's a single point of focus inside the brain of one being. It's embodied in a certain way and has a kind of singular focus. And it struck me after a long while that actually the way that you three work together, and I've been sometimes welcomed into this kind of collaborative way of thinking, is perhaps a reason that you take a particular interest in these forms of other forms of intelligence or of creativity. You know, somehow plants are collaborators, and sometimes chemicals and curators and scientists and British Antarctic Survey, and it seems like you particularly have some kind of empathy with something else, some other way of thinking or doing or working. And I think it would be very interesting for us to hear a little bit about how you work together, and how is it possible after 23 years or so that you're still kind of imagining these creatures and these beings and these experiences.
I think it's a really interesting point you're making about maybe also placing authorship elsewhere than just within yourself. So for us, of course, as a collective, there's that. Then we have written over many years a book which is called Unter Tage, where we actually get even one step further, where we must place authorship with a completely different entity on consciousness, as in soul and minerals, and ascribe the way technological development has progressed over the last hundreds of years to the will of that other entity. Working together, a lot of luck and patience.
I think there are two things for me. One is the way we develop technology, and artificial intelligence is part of this. And which begs the question, what is intelligence anyways? And if we ask that question, we then can deduct how we develop intelligence, such as KI or AI. And so that's one question. I can just leave that sitting in the room. And the other one is, and again, that's quite a personal thing. I feel that the technological tools that are afforded to us, and especially digital technology, with all its tentacles of social media and so forth and so on, has heightened a kind of a sense of individualism. Mm. That for me, over the years of working together, has become more meaningful because of that as well, where an increased lack of community is for me a phenomenon we can witness in society. So yeah, it has become meaningful to me on that level as well.
And dealing with the two other real life human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Constantly.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to our
Thanks for coming.